So let me start by introducing our speaker today, Rhiannon. She's a lecturer at the University of Sheffield, and she has been widely involved in the liquid argon neutrino experiment since 2015. She's currently the co-convener of the oscillation group at the SBNE experiment and at the DUNES, and is the DUNES Physics Calibration Group convener. And today, this talk will introduce the SBNE experiment, its exciting physics goals, and the expected impact on the future of particle physics. So join me in welcoming Rhiannon.
So, as Ivana said, I will be talking to you today about SBNE. I don't believe Raoul is involved in SBNE, and I'm going to be assuming that from now on. So, I will introduce some of the sort of physics, the underlying physics that we are working towards sorting out. And then I will walk through how the detector works. I will talk about, I should probably move to my introduction slightly. I will.
Might need to click.
Oh, you might need to click
Yeah.
the slides again to make it work.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I hope that's okay.
Ivana, are
Yeah.
you recording?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's still working a minute.
It was.
Yeah.
If you click on the slides again.
Yes.
Ah, there you go. Something's
Oh,
happened.
we have something. Okay. This is the slide I wanted. Let's see. Okay. We have movement. Great. Yes. So I will start by introducing the short baseline experimental neutrino physics landscape. I will then talk through liquid argon detection in general in the context of neutrino physics, experimental neutrino physics. I will then talk very much more specifically about the short baseline near detector, which is the focus of this talk. And then I'll run through the SBNE physics program in each of its three major parts. And then I'll get to talk to you about sort of how we got to the point of operating SBNE and where we are at right now. Yeah, so getting straight into it. I'm hoping this is not news to anybody, but of course, neutrino oscillations were discovered at the turn of the century through a combination of measurements by Superkay and Snow, and was awarded the 2015 Nobel Prize. And the reason I'm bringing this up is just to highlight the fact that basically since then, experimental neutrino physics has largely been involved in trying to constrain the parameters which govern neutrino oscillations, get precision measurements from those, and decipher any anomalies that we see along the way. And so the equation at the top here is the equation that primarily governs neutrino oscillations. It's parametrized by the PM/Ns mixing matrix that I've highlighted in red and the squared mass splitting that I've highlighted in blue. And this is an expanded version of the PM/Ns matrix here. And this is the current status of the measurement landscape for these parameters. NuFIT was down 2 days ago, but thankfully Google Images saved the day. So this is as of, I think, November 2025. And I've specifically just pulled out the normal ordering assumptions with the joint Superkay atmospheric data as well. So this is kind of current status of neutrino oscillation physics in the broad scale. However, I'm not going to talk specifically about active neutrino oscillations. I will get to that shortly. But I'm going to narrow us down towards the short baseline regime as we go through here now. So yeah, the way that we measure these parameters is by setting up experiments with specific energy ranges and what we call baselines, i.e. the distance of the detector to the source of the neutrinos. And these two parameters are L and E. And so this can be done to basically tune your experiment to any given set of parameters that you would like to measure. So for instance, in what we call the reactor range, reactor neutrino oscillation experiments, moving towards the solar range, although that baseline is so large, it's very hard to sort of show on a plot. If you look at the x-axis of this distribution, we have an L over E up to a sort of 100,000, and you can see the general shape of what we call the slow oscillations. And you can also see within that what we call fast oscillations. And this is because the oscillation probability is a summation over multiple mass splittings. and mass red splittings govern the frequency of the oscillations. And so at this range, you are largely sensitive to delta M squared 2 to 1, which is the slow oscillation. So I've drawn sort of like dashed lines over it so you can see the sort of shape. But of course, it'd be very, very difficult to unpick the really fast oscillations at this range. So what you can do instead is you can place your experiment in a different location. I'm going backwards. Sorry. If you place your experiment in a different location and effectively zoom in on this x-axis, you can then pick out the behavior of the faster oscillations, but you then lose sensitivity to the slower oscillations. So in the long baseline accelerator atmospheric region, we have L over E's up to sort of 1,000, and you become more sensitive to the delta M squared 3.1, delta M squared 3.2. And if you zoom in even further, so what we're effectively doing is I've shown you the broad scale here. For the long baseline, I've zoomed in just to here. And then for the short baseline, I've zoomed in just to here. And so you can see that at this short baseline where L over E heads up to about 1, you should not be sensitive to any of these oscillations whatsoever. So yeah, that's why these experiments are set up, are to be able to measure things that are not necessarily related to these oscillations. That being said, short baseline experiments, gallium reactor and accelerator setups have all, many of them have reported anomalous data. So they weren't necessarily looking for oscillations, but they have observed signals which could be construed as an excess or a deficit in particular neutrino flavors. Two examples are LSMD and Miniboom, and they observed what we call the low energy excess. So you can see the data sort of sitting quite high above the expectation at these low energies. And this is, like I say, called the low energy excess. And then from there, many, many, many theories, I believe about 100 theories exist to try and explain this, but the dominant one, which has been constructed to try and explain away this excess, is the existence of sterile neutrinos. So the idea would be, if your active neutrinos oscillate away from the active regime into a sterile and then back into an active flavor, you would see an excess of electron neutrinos that are not accounted for in the standard active oscillation framework. And so because LSMD and Miniboom observed this excess, Microboom was set up more earlier than expected. Okay, so Miniboom has a baseline of around 500 meters from the source of the neutrinos, and Microboom was built in pretty much exactly the same spot at 470 meters, but with a completely different detector technology in order to better characterize this excess and constrain the systematics that Miniboom and LSMD were unable to nail down. And the main feature is that Miniboom and LSMD could not differentiate between electromagnetic showers produced by electrons and photons, whereas LARTPCs such as Microboom can distinguish between them. And so that was their main systematic, and Microboom was set up to try and mitigate that. Microboom, however, did not see any hint of the low energy excess, and they've since also put out a sensitivity in the 3+1 sterile oscillation hypothesis. So 3+1 is 3 active, plus 1 hypothesized sterile. They covered a large portion of the parameter space at 95% confidence level. And so far, the conclusion is steriles are not the answer to this problem, but it's not 100% conclusive, of course you can't really get to 100%, but SBN, the short baseline neutrino program at Fermilab, will probe all 3 of the possible sterile oscillation channels we can search, which are mu appearance and mu mu and mu disappearance, in order to basically push these orange lines as far into these corners as you can to cover the majority of the parameter space and once and for all rule out the existence, confirm or rule out the existence of sterile neutrinos. I am the oscillation convener and I am a skeptic. But yeah, so that's kind of like the background. That's the motivation for the construction of these experiments. So now I will talk about more of the detectors themselves. So this is a blown up cartoon diagram of the short baseline near detector. The way that this works, we have 2 time projection chambers here, separated by a cathode plane with anoplane assemblies on either side and photon detection systems at the back. So if a neutrino enters the VMV sort of from this direction, say into the page, if it interacts within the detector, it will produce a combination of charged and neutral particles, and those charged and neutral particles will continue to propagate through the detector. As the charged particles propagate, they ionize the argon, electrons are produced, and they are drifted under an electric field towards the anode plane. So the electric field is constructed through the cathode anode plane system. Simultaneously, as soon as those particles deposit anything in the detector, scintillation photons are produced, and they are immediately collected instantaneously by our photon detection system. So that gives you what we call T0, the initial time of the propagation of those particles. And so what we can do is we can use a combination of geometric and kinematic and timing information to fully reconstruct three-dimensional images of the final state particles produced when a neutrino interacts inside them. And the reason we have two drift volumes in SVMV is because the electrons can get absorbed and not make it to the anode plane. So you have to have an optimized drift distance for those electrons to travel in order to collect as many of them as possible. So to maximize the size of the detector, we split it in half so you have two drift volumes to maximize the electron collection efficiency. SVMV, so that was LARTPCs in general under a cartoon of SVMV, but I'll talk more about sort of SVN and SVMV now as well. The short baseline neutrino program is located in the booster neutrino beamline at Fermilab. So we have the target hole here. The beam is fired through SVMD at 110 meters away from the source, through microgreen at 470, to the far detector, which is Icarus, at 600 meters. The SVM program currently consists of the two, the near far detector systems, so just SVMD and Icarus, both in the booster neutrino beam. And these have been designed to resolve more broadly the short baseline anomalies that have been observed in the search for active neutrino oscillations, and more primarily to actually search for sterile neutrinos as well. But all three of these detectors have and will continue to make individual physics measurements as well. They've got reasonably large physics programs for sort of small-scale experiments in the scheme of things. And because they're all LARTPCs in effectively different generations, they are each testing components for June, and so we'll have sort of operational construction and expertise experience built up for June as well. So loads of great reasons to use these detectors. So a little bit about the beam. The booster neutrino beam is primarily muon neutrinos, around 94%, but it does have intrinsic contributions from anti-muons, electrons, and anti-electron neutrinos as well. It's a really well-understood beam. It was also used by Miniboon, the predecessor to Microboon. So we've got excellent flux models. We still, of course, have to constrain the uncertainties. The peak energy of the beam is around 0.8 GeV, and SVMD will hopefully collect around 10 E20 POT of data in its lifetime. And so what this corresponds to in terms of neutrinos is around just under 3 million neutrinos per year. And an interesting feature of the composition of our beam, or the neutrinos in our beam, is that the muon neutrino and electron neutrino fluxes are primarily produced through two and three body decays respectively. And we can use this in a particular way, which I'll talk about shortly. But yeah, I'll refer back to this later. So SVND is a near detector. I've already mentioned this in the short baseline neutrino program. It has 112 tons of liquid argon in its full active volume, and it's 110 meters from the target. And as I say, we say it records over 2 million, but I'm pretty sure we got just under 3 million in the first year of running, which corresponds to the total. It will be 10 to 20 times, or 20 to 30 times more neutrino argon interaction data than is currently available. And so on the right hand side here, I'm showing a breakdown top of muon neutrino final states, and at the bottom, electron neutrino final states, all charge current, but broken down into the types of particles you can expect to see. So the dominant topology in both cases has no charged pions in the final state, followed by one charged pion, followed by one neutral pion, followed by some higher multiplicity of any flavor of pyrum. And that is true for both muon and electron neutrinos. And this is a really, really powerful fact that we can utilize to do precision physics, which I'll talk about later. The feature I said I'd come back to is the fact that SBND is positioned ever so slightly off the center of the beam line. And what this means is that, what this means is that the neutrinos enter the detector from what we call off-axis angles. So the spread is sort of demonstrated here in 8 angular bins. And that means we can effectively separate the detector into off-axis angle segments. And it's, if you're looking at the front face here, this sort of concentric circular effect is shown. So each of the concentric circles will be one off-axis detector. And because of the high rate of neutrinos, we can expect to see at least 10,000 muon neutrinos in every segment. So we're still statistically significant as well. And just to give reference, a 1 degree off-axis angle at SBND just corresponds to 2 meters front face, and it's got a 4 meter front face. Whereas in June, in the June prism setup, 1 degree corresponds to 10 meters at the front face. So this means we can utilize the prism setup without moving the detector. We still get the impact of the off-axis angular effect, which again, I'll talk about shortly, without moving the detector and with a huge abundance of statistics as well. And an initial demonstration here, this is the neutrino energy spectrum. The darkest line is the smallest off-axis angle, and the most yellow line is the largest off-axis angle. So you can see that as you move further off-axis, the peak reduces, but it also narrows. So you have a much stronger handle on your flux by moving off-axis, and sort of you can do combinatorics at the near detector that better mimic your far detector neutrino energy spectrum, just very helpful for fitting in oscillations. Okay. The TPC in general, we have a pretty novel photon detection system. We are testing the XR Coopers, which are contained light bars. For June, this is what one photon detection system module looks like, and they're arranged in this array you can see here as a demonstration, like I said before, on the farthest face in the X dimension and the drift dimension. It will also have PMTs. It's surrounded by a field cage to hold the electric field at 500 volts per centimeter. The electronics are fully submerged in the cold, so that minimizes, well, it optimizes our noise reduction. And then we have anaplanes. So in front of the PDS, the photon detection system, are the anaplane assemblies. So this is 3 wire planes, one after another, each with 3 millimeter separation on copper beryllium wires. One plane, the wires are at the vertical, and the other 2 planes, they are plus and minus 60 degrees from the vertical. And this is what gives us millimeter scale precision on the electrons that we collect to reconstruct the final state particles. And finally, the cathode plane assembly is the one that splits the detector in 2. And this has TPD coated reflective foils, so that because the scintillation photons are produced isotropically, we can maximize the yield of our photons by allowing them to be reflected at the cathode and then collected again at the photon detection system. And so that the reason they're TPD coated is because the PMT will be like, sorry, they're produced at the UV, PMT before this cathode reaction. We also have a cosmic ray tagging system. So SBND is located on the surface of the Earth, and of course that means we have an abundance of cosmic rays. And because our primary signal is muon neutrinos and therefore muons, cosmic ray muons are a very large background to our dominant topologies. So we have a really robust cosmic ray tagging system with 4 pi coverage of the detector. So it sits around all sides. We have a bonus panel on the top as well, so you can do telescopic tagging because most of our cosmic rays are downwards going. So you can, I think we get something like 99% rejection, that might be it's a very effective cosmic ray rejection capability. And we have resolutions on this as well. And these are just constructed of scintillation strips that you can pinpoint the location of the cosmic ray kits in. So, physics. As I mentioned before, SBND will provide the largest data of the largest neutrino orbit cross section data set in our energy range. And a key One of the reasons this is super important is because we are dealing with argon. So the neutrino interaction models on sort of individual nuclei are reasonably well understood and well constrained. But as soon as you plunk that initial interaction model inside a heavy nucleus like argon with 40 protons and neutrons, and at our energy range, you are dominated by intra-nuclear interactions. Anything can happen before those particles leave. So in this example, say your muon neutrino interacts with a proton to produce a neutron and a charged pion. This is very cartoonish, bear with me. The neutron could never escape the nucleus. The pion could do various different things to the point where, rather than seeing just a charged pion in the final state, you end up seeing two charged and two neutral pions. So what this means is that we have to be able to model everything, including the initial neutrino interaction with the nucleon, the nucleus itself, to predict what could happen, and the final state interactions which could occur before anything leaves the nucleus, because it's the particles that we observe that we have to use to reconstruct exactly what the neutrino did in the detector. So this is a real challenge for liquid argon, but it's a very, very interesting one in my opinion. And so this is, I've pretty much covered this. Well, this is like a cartoonized version of what I was saying. So you have this primary interaction with the neutrino, convolved with the nuclear model, hadron transport or FSI, and if hadronization occurs as well, we've got to model that. And so what we're aiming to do is utilize the SVMB dataset to constrain each of these components as best as we possibly can to then propagate those into our Monte Carlo models in June. And the reason we can do this at SBND is that statistical significance not only puts us in a systematically limited region, but it means we can look at really, really neat final states to try and pinpoint correlations between particular final state configurations and final state interactions, nuclear modeling, and initial interactions which take place. So you can break down, for instance, a topology that has no pions in the final state into really granular numbers of protons. You can, again, have granularity in your pion final state, but you can also, with some significance, look at more exotic channels like kaons, tables, lambdas, hadrons, and we can do that, we can do that reasonably readily. So this is the breakdown of the muon neutrino charge current event rate. In general, very much truth level, just looking at a gene interaction simulation, not got any detector effects yet. This is the fundamental what could happen. And then neutral current is listed at the bottom. And the intrinsic component of the electron neutrinos from the booster neutrino beam are also statistically significant, which is pretty unique. So we can make electron neutrino cross-section measurements also broken down into those final states just by looking at the backgrounds in the beam, which is very helpful and very cool. So that is a sort of way that we utilize the power of SVMD for constraining our cross-section models. But we can also utilize the prism feature of SVMD to better constrain our flux. And this is really important in the oscillation analysis in particular, because the flux of the neutrinos at the near detector and the flux of the neutrinos at the far detector, albeit from the same beam, because of dispersion, aren't necessarily a one-to-one mapping. But what you can do, if you separate the detector into the off-axis angles and pull out these different energy spectrum distributions, you can almost do a summation of them to model the far detector's energy distribution better, to the point where when you're fitting from near to far detector, you can better constrain both the flux and the cross-section systematics. And one of the another feature of the prism setup, which is very, very useful, is the fact that electron neutrinos are produced in three-body decays and muon neutrinos are produced in two-body decays, because that quite significantly modifies the kinematics of the electron and the muon out of those interactions, which means you can better understand your cross-section differences in general, but you can also reduce your dominant backgrounds. So the dominant background for an electron neutrino interaction is a muon neutrino neutral current and or interaction. And so by improving your separation of muon neutrino and electron neutrino, you can significantly reduce your pion and neutral backgrounds to electrons. And we can again test, we can use these sort of summations of the nuclear energy spectrum to better constrain all of our concept of models we've done, and ultimately the systematics for oscillations and heat. All of this is, of course, for its own physics goals. But in an ideal world, we'd also extend this to the next generation, which of course we can't do. So I've highlighted here, this is again that nuclear energy spectrum, the second and first nuclear oscillation maxima, and the coverage of the chemical phase space spectrum, which just goes to show that this cross section measurement will make the constraints that we will place on all of the models that we have will be applicable to the chemical phase, which is, of course, ideal. So moving on from sort of neutrino interactions into the oscillation gradient. So SBND is the NIRD in the short baseline neutrino program. And in that role, it will have very, very little sensitivity to any star, would have any very little sensitivity to any star out signal, which means we can simply use it to constrain those models, which I've talked about already. And so that's the power of SBND in this SBN program. And in two out of three of these channels, SBN is projected to have 5 sigma coverage of the previously explored phase space in the sterile neutrino parameter ranges. So the orange line is a 5 sigma, the solid orange line is 5 sigma, and the dashed orange line is 90%. And so you can see we're pushing back out away from the allowed regions quite readily in both of these neutrino disappearance and electron neutrino appearance channels. And even in the electron neutrino disappearance channel, which is unique to SBN to some extent, particularly in the short baseline program, we can even push out to the allowed regions at the 90% confidence level as well. And so SBN is going to directly address the short baseline anomalies. And finally, I'm sure, I hope, tell us what we need to know about sterile neutrinos. Of course, Michael Green have made a pretty confident statement. We just need to put a pin in it now, in my opinion. Okay. And on a sort of nice bonus side to SBND, again, because of the detector technology, the location, and the performance of the photon detection system and the cosmic tagging timing systems, we can also search for beyond the standard model phenomena as well. So just some of the examples of things we could potentially look for signatures of include dark neutrinos, the transition magnetic moment, both of which are alternatives to the mini-boom low-energy excess, alternative theories. But you could also look for axion-like particles, heavy-neutral leptons, Higgs-Bohr scalars, light dark matter, and milli-charged particles as well. Some of these are ongoing searches. Just before I move on to that, though, this is kind of what they would look like in an SBND simulation. Just to give you an idea. Some of these are under investigation already. We have a beyond the standard model sensitivity paper in the works, but these are three current sensitivities, just using Monte Carlo, in the dark photon, heavy neutral lepton, and axion particle searches. So that's really exciting, and pretty sure we've got some database analyses going on as well as the sensitivity paper at the moment. So, SBND started taking data 2 years ago. Yeah, but I was quite heavily involved in the construction of SBND. I spent my LTA out there in 2018, so I was mostly involved in the anode plate assembly construction. But this is same photo image, but it gives you the idea. You can imagine the cathode sort of slicing the middle of the slice there. But you can see the effect of the anode planes, the sort of shear lines, and the photon detection system. So this was completed in 2022, that was me in 2017. So that's the pit in 2017. And then in November 2022, the cryostat was completed in the near detector hall, which was nicely timed, of course. Then we had to transport the detector. So the internal detector I showed you on the first slide was constructed at the D0 assembly building. It then had to be transported around the Tevatron ring to the near detector hall, which they did very successfully in December 2022. So September through December 2022 is a great time, especially given the COVID situation at that point. It was all right, but not great. You then had to install the top cap of the cryostat onto the assembly transport fixture. I always have to write that down because I can never remember that. But yeah, so the top cap was, so we've got the cryostat, we've got the top cap ready, the detector's on its way. So effectively you attach the detector to the base of the top cap and lower it into the cryostat. So that was completed in March of 2023. And in April, that indeed was done. So this is a photo of it being loaded in, which is really cool. The resolution here is not perfect, but yeah, so that was April 2023. The detector was placed inside the cryostat. It was then, these aren't videos. It's not upside down, pretty sure. I never assume I can show anything but a PDF, so I don't bother with videos. But in theory, there is a video. And you can see this is empty and then this is the filled Liquidag online. So this is March 2024. So we've actually jumped a good year there. Don't ask me why, I can't quite remember. There'll be some reason, I think. I'm not even speculating, but there was a year and we built the detector in March 2024. And then after a bit of a rocky start, we successfully ramped up to high voltage in July of 2024. And you can see on Ella, absolutely buzzing there. But that was an interesting couple of months. So yeah, we finally got our neutrinos in July. So these are our very first recorded, well, some of our very first recorded neutrinos. So on the left, we've got a new ECC candidate. So you can see this is the long muon track. This is a little proton track. It's a lovely example of a candidate quasi-elastic interaction because they're almost at 90 degrees from one another. So in an ideal world, it all looked like this. We could just say, yeah, it's a quasi-elastic interaction. No FSI happened. Here's some physics, but it doesn't work like that. Most of the time, they look like this. So this is again the muon. And then you've got some combination of possibly a proton, possibly a charged pion. It's got a bit of a kink, so maybe that could have decayed to a muon. And then because you have a distance from the neutrino interaction vertex to these electromagnetic showers, we know that this was very likely to be one, if not two, neutral pions that have decayed to two photons. But that's the kind of thing we're now trying to, like, you know, piece together computationally. And I've just said all this in words. But yeah, what did I hypothesize? I wrote this slide a while ago. So I reckoned it was, yeah, pretty much what I said. Most likely charge for resonance interaction with some combinations of protons and charged pions as the short tracks. So yeah, in short, the neutrino, as I've mentioned already, neutrino interactions on argon look really nice in our detector, but they're very, very tricky to interpret, particularly at the point that the physics of the neutrino have actually lost it. But of course, that's why it's not. So now, I've whizzed through this. This is kind of where we're at. I've managed to sort of corral all the latest talks I can find with all the public information. This is where we're up to. So this is how the detector is performing on the right-hand side. So the plot at the top is the electron lifetime as a function of sort of literal time. The nominal is around 3 milliseconds. So not this dotted line here. This is what we've always quoted as nominal, but it's
sorry, what's the electron lifetime?
Right. So, you know how I said the electrons drift towards the anode plane? So the charged pions ionize, the electrons drift. The lifetime governs how many of them will be absorbed before they reach the anode plane. So you want to maximize that lifetime to maximize your acceptance of the electrons. So yeah, nominal has always been 3 milliseconds, and that's kind of what governs the 2 meter drift distance decision. But we are consistently exceeding 30 milliseconds, apart from when they were pumping, so not a bit. But yeah, we're consistently exceeding 30 milliseconds. And at one point, we thought it was close to infinite, which was really exciting, but not very realistic. But still, this will do. We are very happy with this performance. We've also recorded, so protons on target is the way we measure exactly how much beam has been delivered to the detector. So this is a recording of how much, how many protons on target we have had the opportunity to record and how many we have recorded. And because the lines largely overlap, the collection efficiency is 98.6%, which is exceptional. And that basically means that when our shifters are on shift, if the DAC goes down, they restart it very, very fast. So kudos to our shifters. You clean this up. And then the photon detection system and the cosmic ray tagging system are both heavily involved in our timing reconstruction. And so because you can see really clear peaks in these two plots, what that means is we have really fine granularity at the nanosecond level, which means we can basically look every pulse of protons that enters produces neutrinos. We can look between those pulses for potential beyond the solar model phenomena. So you can look even at beam time for non-beam activity between the timing buckets, which is really cool. But it also means that in general, when we're reconstructing our neutrinos, our T0 is really, really precise, which is ideal. And it's very, very good in a cosmic ray tagging scenario for removing our dominant background. And we have paper memory for this as well. We've also recently demonstrated set our sensitivity to low energy activity. So this is the distribution. Well, this is just with what's the PXE here? Not sure. This will just be our sort of open data sample, which is really small. But this is demonstrating the reconstructed energy of Michel electrons, which are produced at the end of stopping neon tracks sometimes. And so they are very, very low energy. You can see around the sort of tens of MeV range, which is very, very good that we can do for our electron searches. And you can also see really clear separation between our muons and our protons. So this is the energy deposited per unit length versus the residual range of the track. So every hit on the anode that we record on the anode plane is some distance from the stopping point of the track, and that's known as the residual range. And so the smaller residual range, the closer you are to the stopping point, and stopping tracks characteristically record what we call the Bragg peak, which is a high increase in the energy depositions. But each particle, because of the mass differences, has characteristic stopping power, this distribution. And if you can separate those, you can separate your particles, you can form PID, nice and computational, carrying the gene of physics. So this is an example of a separation between the muon track. So that's really good. And what that means is that we can record all the images and we can also use them very well. So we're being able to analyze these by eye, but when we have 3 million of them per year, we really have to be able to nail this down computationally. Okay, yeah, so this is my final slide. This is the list of sort of ongoing and near future measurements that are underway right now. Our primary program is the cross-section program, as you can see. We have a bunch of these exclusive topological channels under investigation. CC inclusive always comes first. It's generally what is constructed that everybody else carries on from. But we're looking at zero pi with one and two protons. These are characteristic of the initial state quasi-elastic interaction, and also short-range correlations within the nucleus, which is the whole thing. One charged pion, one neutral pion, one eta, which decays to two photons in the same way as a neutral pion, but with a different invariant mass peak. But we are sensitive to eters, and so again, this could be good background rejection for our shower searches, and even coherent scattering. We're also looking at some neutral current measurements, which are often characteristically harder because if you don't have your lepton to pinpoint your vertex, in the busyness of these event displays, it's quite difficult to determine what's actually from the neutrino interaction and what's just general noise or background. So neutral current interactions are very, very useful to get good at. And we're also looking into electron neutrino inclusive, charge current inclusive, and one charge pion as well. In the oscillation program, we have quite a few different measurements going on at the moment. Because of all the characteristics of the detector I've discussed already, we've got a number of analyses ongoing that are performing the oscillation search with different channels. Again, because of the increased ability to constrain the systematics with the near detector. So we have a standard Mimi disappearance search with an inclusive sample. So all the muon neutrinos that interact via the charge current, which is the standard way of measuring these. But we also have a variety of measurements ongoing, which either look at just zero pi one proton, so you're looking for that really clean muon and proton, because again, it's often very characteristic of a very simple topology. So it means you have, it means you can reconstruct your neutrino energy with a sort of higher confidence level. But you can also separate into many of these different channels and fit them together to constrain multiple of the initial interaction possibilities at the near detector to then again send off those systematic constraints to the far detector. We're also looking at new reappearance with charge current inclusive, so that largely involves the far detector. But again, at this point in time, we're focusing on CC inclusive, the NUI, but in theory, again, we could look at those exclusive channels. And in the not too distant future, it has been dabbled with at the sensitivity level in the simulation. We're also looking to put out a joint fit of a NUI disappearance and a NUI appearance search at the same time. For the sort of ultimate sensitivity to sterile oscillation parameter spaces. And we're also looking into neutral current oscillation searches, which is a whole other kettle of fish. We have one PhD student looking into this, and it's in its reasonably early stages, but it should be quite an interesting study. And yeah, we have a whole BSM program, so I've already shown you the sensitivities of a few of these. The sensitivity paper is on its way out, and in parallel, they are also propagating through the unblinding process in order to actually search for these things in data. So we have a lot of stuff going on. I can't show you an actual video right now, but we are on the road to it. So yeah, that's pretty much everything for me. This is a really nice time to be on SBND, people in the UK. But we have such a variety of physics measurements that students and myself can get involved in, that it was, there's sort of no end to what we could do with the detector, especially with structure. So it's like the younger sibling of the microgrid Nicholas family. But it's a really nice collaboration. We took our first data in 2024 and it's looking really good. So everybody is really happy. It's a testament to a huge amount of work over the last 10 years. And of course, we're hoping that this will pave the way nicely for June. And I've listed all the measurements that are ongoing, and last year Sheffield hosted the collaboration meeting, which was absolutely lovely to show our collaboration there. So yeah, that's pretty much everything from me. Any questions or clarifications for jargon that I think that's going to happen?
Yes. Any questions?
I probably explained it, but I didn't take it in. What are you doing with the Nicholas Simulator?
No, wait, so we're not doing things that microgrid and Nicholas are not. We're working with Nicholas.
I know, but I mean, why do you need to add the new detector?
Ah, what's the role of the near detector? Okay, so the role of the near detector is pretty much for constraining systematics. So if I go right back to you, if we did not have a near detector in an oscillation search, you are fully relying on the model of your beam to tell you exactly how many muon neutrinos, electron neutrinos, etc. to expect. Simultaneously, you're also relying on that to constrain your selective model as well. But with the near detector, particularly a near detector with the same technology, you can use it to constrain.
It's the near. It's not. You were emphasizing the more modern sibling, and I wasn't sure.
It's the more modern sibling that came online last. But yeah, so Icarus also has a cross-section program. Icarus and Microboon are also sensitive to the NUI beam, which is the neutrino, I can't remember what it stands for. So they can do a whole physics program with a different beam. Microboon has its cross-section program. Microboon's sterile neutrino search was a joint fit between booster neutrino beam and NUI beam data, which was really interesting and unique. But SBND, yes, is the main detector. In the BMB, so. Yes.
You're emphasizing the lifetime of the electrons, size of the detector. You didn't talk about diffusion. I vaguely understood from gaseous TECs that without a magnetic field, the diffusion.
Yeah, that's another reason for. Electron lifetime and diffusion are both critical parameters we have to constrain for sure. Again, because of the size of the detector, diffusion is affected. It's not zero by any stretch, but it's minimized because of that that scale choice. So because they are only ever traveling a maximum of 2 meters, the diffusion isn't huge, and you can and the diffusion constants are constrained as part of the calibration program. So it's there. One of the things that the calibration group are doing is you can group some of the, because they're 3 millimeters separated, you can group some of the wires together to do electron lifetime measurements and see how many wires you have to group before things start, how few wires you have to group before things start changing. So you can do quite a lot to model the diffusion, and that's effectively what we do. We model it and constrain it and calibrate it, but it does happen.
So actually, I had a similar question, but maybe just on that a little bit more. You quoted some numbers, and I couldn't quite remember what you said. I think you said you see a lifetime 30 microseconds.
Milliseconds,
sorry.
Yeah.
And wait. What was your predicted one?
No, sorry. We see above 30. I say the predicted, it's a bit of a legacy value, actually. But I suppose it was a design phase. 3 milliseconds is the minimum, have to be above 3 milliseconds in order to record enough electrons to do with physics.
Right.
And so anything above 3, and preferably towards infinity, is ideal. So the fact that we're 10 times more than that consistently is great. It means haven't completed a plot. There's a really nice plot of it. We still measure the electron lifetime routinely. We still measure the electron lifetime because it's a measure of the impurities in the detector. So the more impurities you have, the more electrons are absorbed for booting the anode planes, and that manifests as a reduction in the number of electrons that fall on the network, a reduced lifetime. And what it means is it kind of means that the charge depositions you record at the anode end up being higher than the charge depositions you record at the cathode, because the ones that initially start at the cathode have to drift the whole way across the detector, and so you effectively have a reduction in how much charge you record if you go travel further. And so ideally that would be flat, there would be a difference, and so the electron lifetime, say this is your cathode, this is your anode, and this is the y-axis is also charge deposition. In an ideal world, you would have the same charge deposition no matter where the electrons come from in the detector. As your lifetime goes down, it goes like this, and so you have to recover artificially the electrons you want to this end of the detector. And so we're sort of seeing a lifetime that looks a bit like that. Nominal is about that. But minimal is that. We're seeing that. Infinite is that.
So you were aiming at a minimum number, and what was your expected number?
We don't really give an expectation. The minimum is set based on the systematic scale that imposes. And so,
the reason I'm asking is because in Dune it ended up being a lot longer than was originally anticipated.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how that matches with your original expectations and observations.
This is kind of what I meant. So yeah, because of Protogen, I think Protogen gets around like 35.
It was like a lot more than.
It was
and as you say, it's a critical design parameter, so
yes.
It could have got away with much bigger spaces.
Yeah. So I think the nominal comes from the same era of the Dune nominal at 3 milliseconds, because again, it's in the design phase. So our expectation, because of the performance of Proto-Dune, was that we can do better.
Okay, so is that where you were using that for your... Okay.
Yeah, so the baseline is set based on the systematics we can allow in the design phase, Yeah, so that just dictated the sort of size of the build. So what the favorite models we're going to make is slightly wider.
Okay, so your expectation wasn't before prejudice. So that's where I was coming from.
No.
Okay, yes.
In the original timeline, SV and DM Proto do SV, we're going to tell at the same time. I had a choice when I started my PhD.
Okay.
Made the right one, didn't I? Yeah. Sorry, that was a very long minute, but we're getting to this plot and explaining that.
Right, thank you. There aren't any other ones. I have another question.
I was just wondering what was the lithium?
Oh, it's because they tripped the pump and then recovered it. So the purification system tripped. So lots of impurities came in.
I mean, that's a nice
demonstration.
Yeah, let's say that you might have done it on purpose. I don't actually know, just to test it. Is it really this good, or should we just try and doing it? No, but yeah, so there's, I don't know if you can actually see it from the back, but there is a band that gives the time of the start of that drip and the end of that drip.
And so you get something you're
And I fit the blue and the orange with the different sort of things. And so one, the call and death, not really sure why. Sorry, for me.
I'm just thinking your detector is on modest size. I mean, would be tempted to put a main thing brand new.
We have to cut costs and so many. We were supposed to have an overburden. That didn't happen. No, I don't think we necessarily need the magnetic field for the physics we want to do. I mean, yes, you could sort of separate your intrinsic anti-neutrinos, I suppose, by popping the electric field, but yeah, I don't think it was ever in the design. I know the overburden was, and then it had to be cut for reasons, but I don't believe the magnetic field was ever in there. And the building was constructed for the detector as well, so in theory they could have popped it in, but it was never a choice that they made. Yes.
Okay, thank you for the nice talk. Is it okay if I ask two questions?
Yeah.
So the first one is related to the prism that you did.
Yeah. Okay. Hi again. I just want to know more about this one. Please ask the question, not on the slide.
It's rather simple. So I was just curious if SPND uses the same fitting method as tube prism.
So I actually don't know. So the fitting groups we use, I don't know, to be honest with you. We've not really collaborated. It's kind of on my to-do list, to be honest with you. But I'm not sure. Got another junior group, please.
That's your next question.
Okay, then I'll just ask my next question. The next question was, I was also curious, like, how do you reconstruct neutrino energy for a neutral current event?
The neutrino energy is largely reconstructed. If it's not a nice, simple, quasi-elastic-like interaction, it's done with calorimetry. And then for the neutrino, so what we probably wouldn't do for neutral current is use neutrino energy as a parameter of fit. We would use harmonic pneumatics. That would be my choice. In terms of how we reconstruct neutrino energy, we would use harmonic kinematics and then some. I don't even think you could recover the missing energy. So I think you would just have to use a parameter that doesn't rely on it. That's another thing that the oscillation group is working on. It's looking at observable kinematics rather than the kinematics to best constrain things.
Thank you. That makes sense.
I have another question about the prism bit of it. So, you know, you have your bins in these sort of like circular sections.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a vague question, but, you know, I was interested in like how that circle binning is chosen.
It varies actually. So this is one example. Yeah. One of my PhD students looked into that this is part of her oscillation search. So you can choose the prism binning in two ways. One of them is constant statistics, one of them is constant angle. And so she's looked at how that choice impacts the sensitivity. And in general, because the statistics are so high, I can work. Another consideration is that 8 bins is a lot computationally. And so she's looked at only 3 bins and 5 bins and 8 bins and compared the sensitivity impact on that as well. So this was the sort of poster child for the prism regime of SBND, which is the concentric circles with constant angle. But of course, these have very, very different areas, so you have very, very different statistics. So it depends on the search you're doing with it, in my opinion. I would always say run a quick sensitivity check to see which choice will suit you best. But I'm not sure why the 8 bin was chosen in the first place. there's probably some backing for that. Maybe it was some statistical number that they set as a minimum. But yeah, you can generally segment it however it suits best.
So just to follow up, maybe I was sort of thinking about it from the dean perspective. Right, the difference here, right, if you don't move it, then I guess you're relying on your vertex reconstruction to make sure that...
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering, like, what that resolution looks like and maybe what systematic uncertainty you're thinking about. Because I can imagine that events might have to move between bins if it's sort of, like, on those borders and whatnot.
Yeah, so I've only looked at... We have only looked at this at the Monte Carlo level at this point, and we didn't delve so well before we do that. But, the virtue, I think she ended up putting like an assumed vertex resolution. It wasn't actually going to happen. So I can't really put a number on that. One other thing we have considered, sorry, just to your first point, like I've mentioned a few times, you can define these segments in such a way that you actually isolate the Icarus front face effectively. And so you can define an angular distribution or an angular component that effectively reconstructs the Icarus neutrino now energy spectrum, which is super useful because then you can sort of like use the rest of the SDNE detector as another sort of almost another detector. Then you know you have almost one-to-one mapping between your energy distribution in both cases. So you can play around with it, but quite a few different things statistically at least.
What happened with the ramp up? Just you had a bit of history and you sort of alluded to it.
What do we call it? Sunset plots. There was a moment they got partway up the ramp up. Yeah, I shouldn't say that. They got partway up the ramp up and everything the detector literally looked like a sunset and it was just terrifying. So we stopped it for a while. And this was just before Neutrino 2024 as well, give us some numbers. And what they ended up doing was just going, just power through, carried on, and it all cleared out. I don't know what the cause was. I don't know if they've sussed it out. I'm sure it must have done that. But 2 years down the line, it's been fine. So yeah, it was, they call it sunset. I can't remember. It was like, if you can imagine the 2D space, some massive amount of electronic noise going on. Yeah. Weird distribution.
Yeah, so you referred to your overburden earlier in the absence of it.
Yes.
And you've got a cosmic veto.
Yeah.
So I was wondering how much of an impact cosmics have. So you're able to identify them and remove them, but
yeah,
does it lead to
space shock?
Any amounts of dead time and
it's not so much
on.
Dead time. It's pretty much phase charge. Thankfully, because Microboon and Icarus have both gone before us, we've got the methods of sort of prioritizing phase charge down pretty well. We can kind of adopt their methods. Obviously, you have to prioritize itself in the detector of interest. But yeah, what it effectively means is because you have so many cosmics traveling through the detector in one go, ionizing the argon, you can end up with an excess of ions that drift towards the cathode, which fires your electric field and end up shifting the charge deposition and distributions as well. And so that is models a map and effectively a matrix that you can just calibrate out effectively. But that is the impact. It's in
okay.
The formation. Of the
so you're not you don't have any dead regions or anything or dead time. You just got to calibrate for it. Okay.
Another reason why the CRT is super helpful. Yeah, lovely.
And even where the actual, I don't know what the density ends up being, you don't have to declare any dead region around a particular track.
No, we just slice up the reconstruction into regions of interest to try and remove them, but you don't have to declare anything like that. I mean, It's of course going to be harder to reconstruct something that's very, very simultaneous or overlapping, but the detector's generally large enough. And the neutrino, of course, neutrinos coming in along the Z direction, obviously largely straight down. And because of the energies, not many of the muons travel upwards. So there's a reasonable ability to separate beams or region from cosmic regions.
So on your BSM page,
yeah,
which was
kind of least about the
thing. Okay, so you whizzed past it at high speed.
Yeah, I couldn't tell. Yeah.
yeah. Okay. So maybe start on page one. So this was really nice, but I just wondered maybe you've got some. Examples of how you differentiate such signals.
Oh yeah, so this is partly why I included the event displays.
Yeah.
So you can kind of see that largely most of them result in some configuration of an electromagnetic shower. And I think what you would end up doing, this is me fully hypothesizing, I've never attended the Sun College. My hypothesis would be that these would have characteristic energy invariant masses or something like that that you could then characterize as each one of these scenarios based on the topological appearance in the detector and the hypothesized energy.
So your dark neutrinos and your axion-like particle, you're using an invariant mass separation.
Yes, well, I would.
Yeah. Yeah.
To me, it's two photons reconstruct two electrons. Yeah, and especially because they do look, you've got a vertex, you've got two showers. And again, you'll have, you know, depending on the energy, you'll have some expectation of the angular separation. You know, maybe
and is the group that's working on this BSM stuff also working with the Beam Prism guys for BSM potential?
I don't know, actually. The main people, like, so... The main groups, I think, are UCSB and Granada,
okay.
I don't know if either of those are involved in...
If you go to the other slide, Pedro Machado definitely has done work. Sorry, this one. Yeah.
Yes.
Machado turns up.
Yeah.
So then he's sort of trying it out still.
Yes. Yeah, he's been on all of it, I believe.
In the Higgs portal stasis, quite interesting.
Sorry, I think there was a genesis both going into BSM prism.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ah.
It's Minnesota.
Oh. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I actually haven't updated these links in a little while, so the main similar response. But yeah, there are some slides if you want to go in
Excellent. Yes, that was a very nice talk. I don't see questions, but we will head to lunch. So if you would like to speak to Rihanna, please join us. And let's thank her again. Okay.
Very nice.
Thank you. I'm one of the people in the